Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the sixth of our online series, The Compassionate Brain, with Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain. Tonight we'll be joined by Dr. Kristen Neff, Professor of Human Development and Culture at the University of Texas. She is broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, and Dr. Hansen is live from San Rafael, California. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'm sort of the introducer for this series. And tonight, our Sounds True team are all here in the Boulder studio. And I'd like you to please welcome Dr. Hansen. So welcome, Rick.
Hi, Randy. And hi, Kristen. I'm very happy to be here with you, as well as with everyone else watching this series. And I've been looking forward a lot to talking with you about self-compassion. For those who may not know, Kristen is arguably the world's leading authority on self-compassion. She certainly did the first research on it. She's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin with a doctorate from UC Berkeley. And in addition to doing some of the very first and continuing to do research on self-compassion, she's written a major book about it, a bestseller actually called Self-Compassion, which has been cited and referenced in places like the New York Times as well as NPR, MSNBC, and so forth. Kristen is also the developer with Dr. Chris Germer at Harvard of a course in developing self-compassion, and they're beginning to field test that program. It's showing great results so far. Maybe we'll get her to talk about that a bit with us. It's a practical way to develop self-compassion for people in general as well as those who are using it perhaps professionally. Kristen has also been featured in the best-selling book and award-winning documentary called The Horse Boy, which chronicled her family's journey to Mongolia, where they trekked on horseback to find healing for her autistic son. So, Kristen, I'm very happy for you to be here, and welcome to this interview series.
Oh, thanks so much, Rick. I'm so excited to virtually meet you.
That's great. Well, great. Okay. Kristen's broadcasting, as it were, from her apartment there in town, kind of a refuge for her. I'm broadcasting from my own converted laundry room refuge, home office, with pictures of my kids in the wall behind me. Well, Kristen, to dive in, I'm going to ask you the question, if I could, that I ask everyone. Why are compassion and the brain important to you personally?
Well, my brain, I'd be lost without it. And compassion, I'd be lost without it also. Compassion has really been a guiding theme in my life for a long time. When I first started learning about Buddhism, compassion is what really drew me to the practice, and in particular, self-compassion, because I just saw how powerfully it impacted my own life. And then in terms of the scientific aspect of the idea that we could look at something as ephemeral of compassion from a very scientific, hard-nosed perspective really just excited the scientists in me. So the coming together of you might say the third person objective and first person subjective, just been really fascinating.
Hmm. Out of all the Buddhist teachings, why did compassion pop out for you as particularly central?
Well, so I actually started to learn how to meditate in Berkeley. It was my last year getting my PhD, and I was under a lot of stress. Go figure. And I'd also gotten out of a very difficult personal relationship. I was getting out of a divorce. And I thought, maybe I should just learn how to meditate. It would help me feel calm, help my stress. But the very first night I went to the Buddhist group, the woman talked about the importance of compassion, and particularly compassion for oneself. Mm-hmm. And I had known Buddhists talked a lot about compassion for others, but I hadn't really heard the message that it was very important to give compassion to yourself as well. And quite honestly, I just really needed to hear that message in my life at that moment. I was judging myself, I was feeling stressed, I was feeling insecure about my future, and I started practicing compassion. So way before I figured out this mindfulness meditation thing, I started trying to be kinder to myself, and it made an immediate difference. So I guess you might say it worked, and
that's
what I got interested, yeah.
Well, let's clarify maybe some of the words we're using here. So first off, what do you mean by compassion? And then what do you mean by self-compassion?
Yes. And I actually don't see compassion and self-compassion as different. I think the problem is most people exclude themselves from the circle of compassion. So I really see self-compassion as just also giving compassion to yourself. But I've actually defined compassion as having three main elements. The first is maybe the most obvious, being kind to yourself, treating yourself with the same care, consideration, empathy that you would show to a good friend. Unfortunately, most of us are much harder and cruel even to ourselves than we are to other people we care about. So self-compassionate means when we see something about ourselves we don't like or we go through a hard time, we're kind, supportive, and non-judgmental. But also important, more than maybe that more obvious element of compassion, very important is that we frame our experience in light of the shared human experience. And that's partly why I see compassion for self and others as the same, recognizing that the human experience is imperfect. And in fact, we are imperfect. So the trick is to open our hearts to the whole imperfect human experience, ourselves included, remembering that we aren't alone in our imperfection, we aren't alone in our suffering. Often we tend to feel very isolated when we notice something about ourselves we don't like or something goes wrong. But with compassion, we recognize this is part of something we all go through. And then the third component is actually mindfulness. We need to pay attention to turn toward, to stop for a moment resisting and trying to fix our suffering, to pause and say, wow, this is really hard. And we need to pause and recognize our suffering so that we can actually give ourselves compassion. So that's a way to find it. So with self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness.
That's great.
The short version is being a good friend to yourself.
That's right. Question about common humanity. I get the part about normalizing. In other words, having a sense that, okay, I'm, you know, for example, other people get angry too, or other people feel sorrow, other people are afraid, other people feel inadequate. That was real clear. And then you brought in more of the notion of imperfection. And I was wondering how you related the imperfectibility of life, if you will. The way they're trying to perfect life is like polishing Jell-O. It doesn't work really well. How do you relate that to compassion? As you say, both, you know, since it's the same thing, compassion, it's only the object that differs, the target, if you will, that differs. You know, compassion for all beings, including the one who wears our own name tag. So how does imperfection or imperfectibility relate to compassion for you?
Right. Well, so if you look at what happens when we notice something in ourselves that's imperfect or our lives, we get rear-ended on the freeway, for instance, irrationally, there's this sense that something has gone wrong. This should not be happening. This is abnormal. As if maybe before we came into this world, we find that, you know, everything will go swimmingly until the day I die plan, and then we say, hey, I want my money back, and something goes wrong, or we aren't as perfect as we think we should be. And that feeling of abnormality, as if things going wrong shouldn't be happening, actually makes us feel very isolated and cut off from our fellow human beings. In that moment, emotionally, when we look imperfection straight in the face, we feel as if this shouldn't be happening, something is wrong with me, something is wrong with my life, and that makes us feel separate and isolated. So compassion really is opening the heart to everything, the dark as well as the light, the fact that imperfection is supposed to be happening, that is normal. It would actually be quite abnormal if everyone was perfect.
I really appreciate how you're, in a sense, highlighting both the dimension of imperfection and self-criticism. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you're right, I was tuning into myself as you were speaking, just imagining it. And if I think about being compassionate for others, the fact that imperfections are occurring in their life isn't that relevant to me. I mean, things are happening, they're suffering, I wish they weren't, they're sympathetic concern. But you're right, that's great, Kristen, that just the mere experience of imperfection in one's life, I think this is probably true, especially in the West, maybe even in America as the paragon of the West in some sense, in which we're all supposed to have the perfect, shiny, happy lives behind our own gated communities, as it were, where nothing ever, ever goes wrong and every child is above average, right? And when it's not like that, that alone feels isolating. And
yeah,
then
it,
added
yeah,
to that, just like you said, isolating, and then added to that sometimes or often even is a quality of self-criticism. So I wondered if you could say more about how self-compassion works with self-criticism, even antidotes perhaps self-criticism.
Right. Well, it is remarkable when you start tuning into the actual language you use with yourself. One of the things I do when I try to teach people, help them be more self-compassionate, is have them actually write down verbatim what they say to themselves. And it can be quite shocking, the types of language we use. Really, you know, I'm ashamed of you. You're a failure. What a loser. No one's going to love you. I mean, would you say that? Would you even say that to your enemy, let alone yourself?
Depends on the enemy.
Okay, but it has to be a pretty big enemy, right?
That's right. Keep going. It's fine.
remind me not to... No. Yeah, so...
Not to become my enemy, is that it? No worries.
Yeah, so... I mean, the interesting thing in terms of the role that self-compassion can have for overcoming our self-criticism is, ironically, to stop the patterns of self-criticism, we actually have to start having compassion also for our inner critic. We don't want to fall in the trap of judging ourselves for judging ourselves. So when we start seeing that, in a way, what our self-criticism is doing, Rick, is it's trying to keep us safe. Self-criticism actually, at the physiological level, taps into the threat defense system. The amygdala gets triggered and says, oh, there's a problem. You look in the mirror and you don't like what you see, or something bad happens in your life, and you become frightened. This is a problem that needs to be solved. And especially, you know, back in the old days, the amygdala got triggered when a lion was chasing us, but now the attack is typically to our self-concept. So when we see something about ourselves we don't like, we get frightened, our amygdala gets triggered, and we start attacking the problem. The only downside is the problem is ourselves, so we start attacking ourselves to try to fix the problem. So what self-kindness does, especially when self-kindness gets actually turned towards self-criticism itself, is starts to recognize, oh, I see, says to the inner critic, you're actually trying to keep me safe. Well, is there a more productive, healthy way we can keep safe other than beating myself up, basically?
That's interesting. I was wondering what you would say to the question of why do you think people tend to be more critical of themselves, much more, and as you point out, viciously,
yes,
harshly critical toward themselves rather than toward others. And then from what you were saying there, it struck me that when others fall short from standards, often it's not perceived as a threat to me. Right. Sometimes it is, and then we criticize others, or if only inside our own mind. But often it's not that salient. But when we fall short of standards, that then is perceived as if a lion were attacking us, in this case our own self-concept, and then it's a threat, and we kick into gear that self-criticism cascade. And it seems to me, in part, you're proposing that self-compassion is an alternative to that. But how do we prevent the pitfall of getting so self-compassionate, as it were, that we inappropriately let ourselves off the hook and we don't appropriately have wholesome aspirations?
Right. So I would say that two of the major blocks to people being more compassionate with themselves is, one, the confusion between self-compassion and self-indulgence. And then the very related confusion or misperception that self-compassion will undermine your motivation to reach your full potential or reach your goals. So let me talk about self-indulgence first, because this question comes up. Can you be too self-compassionate? Mm-hmm. And that's because people confuse being compassionate and kind with yourself with giving yourself pleasure. All right. So compassion, and I actually didn't define it this way in the beginning. I should have. Compassion, by definition, is concern with the alleviation of suffering. It's the wish that sentient beings, are self-included, be happy and free from suffering. Now, indulgence means that you're giving yourself short-term pleasure, even though it causes long-term harm. So it's very easy to see with parents and their children. Let's say there's a mother, very, you know, ideal, compassionate mother, her kid says, "Mom, I don't feel like going to school today. Can I just skip school? And gosh, the kind of three, you know, tubs of ice cream, I'm feeling kind of hungry." A mother would not indulge her child that way. That would not be compassionate. A compassionate mother says, "No, you got to go to school. You got to do your homework. You have to eat your vegetables. You got to go to bed on time." Because compassion is always aimed at well-being and the alleviation of suffering. So you can't really give yourself too much well-being, and self-indulgence is actually undermining your well-being. And I actually tell people, sometimes you don't know, is this act, let's say I'm getting a massage, is that self-indulgent or is that self-compassionate? Well, the answer lies in, is that actually enhancing your well-being? Or if you're getting a massage every night and you really can't afford it, is it undermining your well-being? And that's the line there. Mm.
Thank you. Okay, and then besides self-indulgence?
Motivation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Please
yeah.
say more.
Motivation, the fear that self-compassion will undermine your motivation is actually so strong that Paul Gilbert has developed a fear of self-compassion scale. Some people are so attached to their self-criticism, they believe that the whip, the self-flagellation, is the only way they can get themselves moving. Okay, and if you think about what motivation with self-criticism is, the carrot, so to speak, is feeling okay about yourself, or at least not hating yourself, and the stick, what drives you, is the harsh self-criticism. I'm going to try, I'm going to do it, because otherwise I will just beat myself up and it will be so painful. It is really not an effective motivational strategy. So what happens when we criticize ourselves? Again, we activate our threat defense system, we trigger our amygdala, we release cortisol, we get very stressed. Eventually, after persistent stress, the body shuts down and becomes depressed as a way to handle that over arousal. So self-criticism and depression go hand in hand. And we know being depressed is not exactly the best motivational mindset. The other thing self-criticism does is it makes us lose faith in ourselves because we're cutting ourselves down all the time. Also, we know from the motivation research that belief in yourself, it's called perceived competence, is the number one predictor of whether or not you're going to be able to reach your goals, is the degree to which you believe in yourself. Self-criticism also makes you afraid of failure. Okay, if I know that if I fail and I... that if I try and I fail, I will beat myself up, it's easier not to try. So self-compassion takes a very different approach. Mm. Self-compassion actually, instead of tapping into the threat defense system, self-compassion taps into the mammalian caregiving system. When we soothe and comfort ourselves and we're kind to ourselves, it makes us feel safe, just like a little baby monkey feels safe when held in the mother's arms. It releases oxytocin, opiates, actually calms down the nervous system, reduces cortisol. So when we are kind to ourselves, we are actually putting ourselves in the optimal emotional and actually physiological mindset to thrive. Mm-hmm. Let me just give you a quick example. I know I'm going on, excuse me. But
great stuff. Keep going.
Okay, so imagine this. Imagine there is a father, and his son comes home from high school with a failing math grade, like not even a D, F. Father has two ways to motivate the child. The first one is through harsh criticism. The father says, "I'm ashamed of you. You'll never amount to anything. You know, you're a no good loser," right? Does that make you cringe when you think about it? So what's going to happen, the son, yeah, he might study a little bit harder for his next math exam because he has to, but he's going to lose faith in himself, he's going to become depressed, he's probably going to switch to be a basketball major because he doesn't think he can do math. You know, don't we say those things to ourselves? "I'm ashamed of you, you'll never amount to anything." So imagine the compassionate father, the ideally compassionate father, the son comes home with a failing math grade. The first thing the father says is, "Ouch. Ooh, gosh, bummer. I'm so sorry. You must be really upset." hey, don't beat yourself up about it. You know, it happens to everyone. Everyone fails sometimes. It's okay. I still love you. I'm still here for you. But, you know, we got to make sure your math grades are up because you want to go to college. It's very important to you. Here's what self-compassion says. It says, what can I do to help? I believe in you. I'm here for you. How can I support you so that you can reach your goals? So self-compassion still aims towards fulfilling the goals, but out of love, not out of fear of being inadequate. And when you feel loved and accepted and supported, you're going to be in the optimal state of mind to do your best. And the research, there's a lot of research now that absolutely supports this. Self-criticism undermines motivation, puts you in the opposite mindset you really want to be to succeed. Self-compassion, if you help people be kind and compassionate, especially after failure situations, they're more likely to pick themselves up and try again. They're less afraid of failure. They'll work longer towards their goals. Keep persisting in their goals even when they get discouraged. It's a very useful motivational mindset, just like a compassionate parent is going to motivate their child more than a critical parent.
Right.
And child, this is one of my favorite topics, Rick.
Oh, that's fantastic. And because, of course, you're such an authority on this, you are naming a whole lot of solid research findings about the benefits of self-compassion just informally as you go through there. One thing that struck me about what you had to say was that sometimes what happens, of course, is that people shift from, as it were, one horse to another horse, and the horse they originally rode to get themselves through life had a fair amount of self-criticism and self-beating themselves up and so forth in it. When they switch to that other horse, initially that other horse may be slower because it doesn't have that giddy up from being flogged, if you will, or actually maybe they stay on the same horse, but they ride it differently. That's a better metaphor. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, riding this horse with self-compassion, with compassion for the horse and encouragement and empowerment, then that horse really starts running and eventually runs even faster and farther than the horse would have run being whipped all day long. And people just have to live with the fact that initially there might be a shortfall in performance briefly, and I think people need to see this if they're managing others, whether they're parents or bosses at work or managers of a team or whatever, even coaches of teams. Initially there might be a short-term fall off, but in the long term, you're exactly right, and the research shows it, that these other approaches are much more productive in the long haul. The other thing that struck me about what you were saying, Did you want to add something there, Kristen?
Well, that's a good point. And also, as we know, there actually is a beneficial role of stress in motivation. We don't want to be continually stressed, overstressed, but small amounts of stress are good. There's a reason we have cortisol. It activates the fight or flight response. It gives us adrenaline. It gets us ready to do something. So the issue is we don't want to get rid of stress. And we don't want to pretend that if we're self-compassionate, we'll just be, yeah, it's cool, whatever. But there's enough stress in terms of just the stress of real life and situations, the stress of a deadline coming up or a big homework assignment you've got to prepare for. So instead of creating stress by criticizing yourself, just really reorienting yourself to see the stress of, well, is there a danger? Is there something that I really need to pay attention to that's important, then you can actually get that same stress to motivate yourself without it having to be the overwhelming stress of self-criticism. If that makes sense.
Yeah, complete sense. Yeah. I mean, also building on what you were saying, I've seen a lot of situations where people dream small dreams, if you will. They don't reach for the stars. They don't pursue wholesome aims, in part because they're afraid that if they set up the aim, and then if they fall short, they'll feel terrible as a result. So what they do then is they scale down their aims to make sure that it's within their comfort zone. And yet, if they had more capacity, more of an inner resource of self-compassion, then they'd be willing actually to aim even higher because they wouldn't be so afraid, if you will, of the potential risk or pitfall of really feeling horrible about themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Very strong negative relationship between self-compassion and fear of failure. And as we know, all the great inventors say, I think was it Edison that said something about, and he had tens of thousands of failures, and then he had the one success, but then every single failure he learned from it.
Yeah.
Most people who are very successful say they learn more from their failures than from their successes, actually. So being able to be okay with a failure means you can learn from it, which means that's actually going to help you learn and grow and eventually succeed.
Right. You know? This might be a good point for you to clarify the distinction between self-esteem and self-compassion.
Ah, yes. So just to go back a little in the history, I became interested in self-compassion when I started practicing Buddhism, finishing my PhD. But then I did a two-year postdoc afterwards with a leading self-esteem researcher, Susan Harder. And while I was working with her, I started realizing that psychology had really been falling out of love with self-esteem, that although we know it's good to have self-esteem as opposed to not have it, it's certainly not good to hate yourself or to feel like you aren't worthy. The ways people get their high self-esteem is not always so healthy. Okay, so by self-esteem, I'm talking about a global positive self-evaluation, kind of putting yourself in a box labeled good. And we know it's better to be in a box labeled good than a box labeled bad if you had a choice. The problem is to get ourselves into that box labeled good. The first problem, as you mentioned before, is everyone has to feel special and above average to feel okay about themselves, right? If I said, Britt, this programmer, you know, yes, it's average. It's an average web program. You'd be devastated. If you told me my interview was average, I'd be devastated. You know, it's not okay to be average. It's an insult to feel to be told that we're average. So we're constantly comparing ourselves to other people. How do I compare to them? Am I better? Am I worse? Sometimes that can start being really nasty. For instance, the bullying problem we see with middle schoolers. That's the way middle schoolers are trying to get their self-esteem. They don't have much else to go on, so being bigger and stronger and picking on the you know, weird kids, that's the way they can feel good about themselves, feel special and above average. It can lead to narcissism. There's actually a narcissism epidemic in this culture because of all the emphasis on self-esteem. Ego defensive anger. When you get most angry at your partner when they say something that pricks your ego, right? So the other problem with self-esteem is that it's contingent, right? Mm-hmm. So it's there when we succeed. And for women, the number one domain in which we invest our self-esteem is appearance. So, okay, if you're feeling okay about the way you look for a while, then maybe you have some self-esteem, but then you open the first, you know, magazine you look at, and even the supermodel is going to feel insecure compared to the other younger supermodel on the magazine cover. It's an unwinnable game. So it's contingent on being better than others, but someone's always doing it better.
Yeah.
And it's contingent on success, but you will always fail. I mean, that's part of life. You can't always succeed. So self-esteem really deserts you when you need it most, when you fail or make a mistake or times are tough. And that is precisely when self-compassion steps in, when you notice you aren't as good as you'd like to be in some area, or you notice you've made a mistake or you're really struggling. Self-compassion is not about judging yourself positively. Evaluation plays no role in self-compassion. Self-compassion is about relating to yourself kindly, whether it's a good day or whether it's a bad day. And so for that reason, self-compassion is always available. And there's a lot of research now supporting that unlike self-esteem, self-compassion isn't associated with social comparison, isn't associated with narcissism or ego-defensive anger. And the sense of self-worth that comes from self-compassion is much more stable because it's there when you succeed and when you fail.
That's great.
So it's a better alternative. We don't really have to ask ourselves constantly, am I good enough? Just try being kind and supportive to yourself and you know, be the best you can, and that's all that really matters.
In a moment, I want to get to how we can cultivate more of this kindness toward ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But first, you've spoken about blocks to that self-kindness, self-compassion that originate from within oneself.
Mm-hmm.
What about blocks to self-compassion that come from the outside, as it were, from culture, from schools, from other people? people telling us, for example, that if we're self-compassionate, we're going to lose our edge, stay hungry, my friend, et cetera. How can we recognize some of those factors outside of us that are reducing or undermining our confidence in the value of self-compassion and our commitment to it?
Yeah, well, and that, I think that's where the blocks do come from, is we internalize those messages. People tell us, oh, if you're self-compassionate, you really just indulge in self-pity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which also isn't true. Self-pity is, woe is me, very egocentric. Self-compassion is, the human experience is difficult. It's not egocentric at all, and it doesn't exaggerate things. So I think the trick is really just challenging some of these assumptions. Is it self-indulgent? Really? Is it really self-pity to be kind to myself? Is it really going to undermine my motivation? And at some level, the only way you're going to find out for sure is by trying it out, giving it a go, testing this new way of being. But I think it helps to start tuning into, especially with self-esteem, how unwinnable the self-esteem game is, because our entire culture is predicated on it. Our entire marketing culture, advertising, is predicated on, if you buy my jeans, you will be special and above average. Mm-hmm. And once you start kind of saying, well, wait a second, that's not quite right, there's something wrong here, then the whole illusion that's been spun by the media starts unraveling, and we can really start asking ourselves, wait a second, what's really most important? You know, the beautiful thing, Rick, is that we all have a lot of experience with compassion with our friends. Most of us, we know what it feels like to get compassion from our friends. We know how healthy that feels. We know why we want to give compassion to our friends. We know what to say. We know how to support them. We know how important it is for them to feel supported. We wouldn't buy into messages if our culture said, you know, you should really be meaner with your friends and bully them and call them names. You know, we'd say, oh, are you kidding? So we just need to challenge those assumptions when it comes to relating to ourselves and recognize that, no, friendship, compassion, kindness, that is my value. Being number one, you know, doing this hedonic treadmill of always trying to be better than everyone else. I'm just going to get off the treadmill and start being kind to myself.
Oh.
You have to be intentional, though, because the culture doesn't support it. It really doesn't.
Yeah. Have you found in your research or the research of others any common gender differences related to self-compassion?
Yes. So women tend to be a little less self-compassionate than men. It's not huge, and it's not in every single study. I actually, there's a woman doing a meta-analysis now, but we always find it in the direction of women being slightly lower than men. Now, that may be because, in general, women tend to have a slightly stronger negativity bias than men do, to the extent that's true, there may have been some evolutionary advantage to that, being more problem-focused, being more attuned to that rustle in the grass that made you realize, is that a lion or not? And if so, it helps you keep your baby safe. So part of that might be just a general negativity bias. Part of it might be the pressure is higher on women. Certainly that's the case in the realm of appearance. Pressure is higher on women than men. So women tend to be a little less self-compassionate than men. They're more judgmental of themselves. But as we also know, women tend to be quite a bit, sorry guys, but in general, women are more compassionate to others than men are.
Mm-hmm.
And there also is probably some evolutionary reason for that as well as cultural support. Mm-hmm. So you might say the discrepancy among women for how they treat themselves and others is much larger than the discrepancy for men. They're a little more similar how they treat themselves and others.
Mm, that's interesting. Go on.
Well, I was going to say the good news is women are really skilled at being compassionate. They've been socialized for it. Their relationships have encouraged it. They know how to say just the right thing when someone is suffering and needs some kind words of support. So although women are less practiced at doing it with themselves, they actually have the tool in their tool bag. They just need to pull it out and start reminding themselves, giving themselves permission, really, to use it with themselves.
Right. Take that warm glow and direct it to the one being among all others who wears their own name tag.
That's right.
Because they know how to do it already from the inside out. Yeah.
Right.
This is probably a good transition to talking about how people can cultivate qualities of compassion, self-compassion, as well as self-compassion inside themselves, which will then lead us next, we'll get to it soon, about how we can help our children, for example, cultivate more self-compassion and less self-criticism. So let's just start with us as adults. What can people do, whether it's to deal with the gender socialization that you just talked about or with any other factors? What can people do from the inside out? This is probably a good opportunity to talk about your course as well. How can they develop more self-compassion?
Right. So maybe I'll start a little talking a little bit about the course and then talk about a couple of the types of exercises we teach. We do know that mindfulness training itself increases self-compassion when we let go of the resistance to our negative experiences, and especially do it with a kind, gentle way. That is a very important starting point for self-compassion, letting go to the resistance of the imperfection of life, really. But we actually find with the program we just published, a randomized controlled trial, that we got increases in self-compassion that were substantially larger even than mindfulness training alone, in that when you explicitly learn tools how to give yourself compassion in difficult moments in our training program, which is called Mindful Self-Compassion, by the way, we actually have people bring in real-life circumstances they're dealing with, and internally, it's not therapy, but internally, bring skills of self-compassion to the pain they're currently experiencing, so they build the muscle of what it feels like to be kind, supportive, and caring to yourself. Probably the easiest thing we teach is physical gestures of kindness and compassion. So as I mentioned before, what self-compassion does is it taps into the mammalian caregiving system. As mammals, as opposed to reptiles, we are pre-programmed to respond to warmth and gentle tone of voice, gentle pressure. So we teach people to do something very simple, like, see if I can get in the camera here, putting your hands on your heart, or some other physical gesture of affection, is remarkably powerful, because sometimes your mind can't go there. If your mind's full of the storyline of what happened or how you messed up or your fears, when you try to give yourself compassion mentally, sometimes you just, you know, the mind goes off on its journey and it gets sucked away. So a physical gesture of affection to calm and soothe you, we know it actually starts immediately reducing your cortisol levels. Feeling the warmth of your hands over your heart calms you down, activates the parasympathetic nervous system, and then once you are physically calmed and soothed, you feel safe and secure and comforted, then you could start introducing some gentle language to help remind yourself to be kind. The first one actually is, we teach something called the self-compassion break, which is very simple. It calls for the basic components of self-compassion. The first is, I'm going to put hand on heart. This is a moment of suffering. So important to name it. We're often so lost in problem-solving mode, fix-it mode, or self-attack mode, we don't tune into the fact that this is really hard right now, whether it's myself, feelings of inadequacy or shame or just something difficult is happening. This is a moment of suffering, bringing mindfulness to the fact that you're suffering, which is a prerequisite for giving yourself compassion. So this is a moment of suffering, and then recognizing that suffering is part of life. It's part of the shared human experience. It's not abnormal. It's not isolating. This is something that one goes through. Can I, again, helps you open to that, the fact that imperfection and humanity are part of the same thing. And then may I be kind to myself in this moment. May I give myself the compassion I need. And so using kind words that might be, you know, I'm here for you. It's okay. This is really hard, but, you know, I'll support you through this. And I'm so sorry it's difficult. What can I do to help? Is there anything you need right now? words of encouragement about being patient or open or having gratitude, something like that. So starting with the physical gesture and then some language that helps orient you toward the fact that recognizing your suffering, remembering that suffering is part of life, you aren't alone, you aren't isolated, it's not abnormal, and then the words of kindness that can help support you through it. So that would be a type of practice we would teach. And of course, we also do meditation as well. But I suppose in our program, maybe what's a little different is we equally emphasize informal practices like putting your hand on your heart and saying kind words as we do the formal practices like loving kindness meditation. We do other ones as well, like we do a compassionate body scan where you do the classic body scan meditation and bringing awareness to different parts of your body, but anytime you touch either physical pain or maybe a self-judgment, you intentionally bring kindness and compassion to your body, which might even mean, you know, putting a gentle hand if you need to as you're going through the body scan. So those are the, you know, the things can be done. What I think what surprises a lot of people is it's easier than you think. Because we've been doing it our whole lives for other people.
Yeah.
We know what to say. We just have to remember and, again, give ourselves permission, realize it's not self-indulgent. As a matter of fact, if I'm kind to myself, I will be able to keep my heart open, which means my heart will be more open for you. So it's very, it's a very compassionate act to others to be kind to yourselves because it allows you to have the emotional resources you need to actually be there for others and not shut down.
Yeah. Thank you. So those, you would say, the things you went through about your course, those would be things that people can do on their own as well, correct?
Yeah. And on my
they can learn more about in your book, too, I imagine.
Yeah. In my book, I've got exercises, and on my website, I've got guided meditations, and I have some written exercises as well. Another really powerful one, and there's actually two studies now showing that this can have long-lasting changes, is writing a compassionate letter to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a letter from the perspective of an ideally compassionate friend about what you're going through in your life right now. There was one study that had people do that one paragraph self-compassionate letter for 7 days, and it reduced depression for 3 months and increased happiness for 6 months. So those types of conscious techniques can be surprisingly easy and surprisingly powerful.
That's great. It goes again to your point in the, earlier on about how you can do it to people. And if you do it, it will have a benefit for you. If I could add something, I suspect it's embedded in your course. The idea of priming the pump by starting with the felt sense of being cared about as a way to warm up those mammalian circuits, if you will, of the social engagement system and, you know, or in plain English, feeling cared about and connected with others. That's a great way to warm up the capacity to be caring oneself. You know, first we fill up our own cup. We put our own oxygen mask on first.
That's
and then
right.
we have an opportunity to be caring, including toward the one person who wears our name tag. So that's another pump primer that I've seen, starting with a sense of being connected or belonging or liked or seen or included, appreciated, and so forth. Okay, well, how about helping kids cultivate self-compassion and less self-criticism? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, I think one important thing is parents tend to be aware of the fact that they shouldn't criticize their child to have them internalize those messages. But perhaps what they're a little less aware of is that if you criticize yourself in front of your child, that the child is still picking up messages that somehow this is the way to get things done. So maybe a mother is very careful of being almost encouraging and supportive and not blaming her child, but if in front of her child she says, that's so stupid, I can't believe I did that, or gets angry at herself in front of her child, the child will pick up that message. In the research we find, yes, parental criticism decreases compassion among kids, but also just the general level of conflict and fighting in the home. So modeling compassion in front of your children, compassion for others, but also compassion for yourself, is, I think, one important way to give children the message that not only it's is it permissible to be kind to yourself this way, that it's a good thing that's going to help you? My son, for instance, I always say things like, it's okay, it's only human, you know, that's just the way human beings are. And it's been very helpful for him to always come back to just that basic acknowledgement that failure, getting things wrong, is human, and it's nothing out of the ordinary, and it's okay.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying that if a parent were first to be compassionate toward the child would probably internalize that over time. Second, the parent should be careful about criticizing the child, because that'll get internalized too, as
absolutely,
self-criticism,
yeah,
and undermine self-compassion. And also, parents should model self-compassion and healthy aspiration without slipping into the pitfall of self-criticism, because the child will also observe and internalize that. How about helping kids directly, maybe the child analog of what you do in your course, helping children directly learn the competencies, if you will, or the attitudes or intentions of self-compassion. Maybe thinking in terms of preschoolers, then elementary school, and then, God help us, adolescents.
Yeah. You know, I haven't done any work with children yet, and it hasn't really been done in any systematic way. I'm really hoping someone does, because it's so important. I think especially in adolescents. I did do one-day intervention for a high school once, never really followed it up. But especially in adolescents, when identity formation is going on and the self-esteem game really starts kicking in and there's a lot of pressure to look a certain way and to be cool and to fit in, I think it would be so important. I do find talking with teens that because they really feel viscerally the pain of the self-esteem game and how badly it's going for them, that's a nice entree in. If you can point that out, how the unwinnable situation where everyone has to feel above average, you can often get a teen to say, oh, yeah, actually, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, I see, that is probably why those girls bully. They're trying to get self-esteem. Maybe self-esteem isn't where I should be putting my energy, and that's a way in. But, yeah, a lot of work to be done on that, but I suspect it'll be really just modeling the behavior from a very young age so that hopefully kids can grow up with it.
Yeah, and I can imagine parents quite informally, without laying a lot of psychobabble on the kids, especially during that period, roughly 4 to 14, when they'll put up with something, especially if it extends their bedtime. But I can imagine parents just teaching children, for example, to put the hand on the heart, or to model how you might talk to yourself about missing the goal in soccer or getting that F in math, what have you. So I think parents are exploring these methods, and I'm sure they could adapt many of the kinds of things you're teaching. By the way, it's easy to find your book, of course, because it's everywhere. How could people find out more about the self-compassion course that you and Chris Germer have created?
Right. Well, we are actually putting the finishing touches or creating a new website called the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, but it's not quite up yet. So in the meantime, if you go to my website, which you can find, if you just Google self-compassion, it comes up, or Chris Germer's website is mindfulselfcompassion.org. We teach it in week-long formats, intensive formats at various places around the country, like Omega or Esalen or Kripalu. There are also some 8-week programs being offered. UC San Diego is teaching it, and Chris Germer is teaching it in Boston. But at this point, the easiest way would be to take one of our week-long intensives, and we also teach it in New York as well.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But it's really just starting to take off, and now that we've published a randomized controlled trial, I think we'll start seeing a lot more of it as well.
Yeah, great. Well, then, back to challenges for self-compassion, and I want to pose a difficult situation and see what you think about it and how you could advise someone about it. So let's suppose that I'm someone who I'm falling short of certain kinds of standards, to really stereotype a bit here, but let's suppose I'm a young woman and I feel like I'm just not, you know, my appearance isn't really what I want it to be, and I notice factually, actually, that people are bypassing me in part because of it. Or alternately, I'm falling short because I'm not getting good enough grades, or I'm not really hitting it out of the park at work, or let's say, again, stereotyping, male, I'm just not making much money, I'm not very successful in my career, and again, I'm being bypassed. And I can really see that it's happening. I'm not deluded, it's not my self-criticism. Mm-hmm. I really do see that it's consequential, that I'm falling short of these standards. Where does self-compassion fit in those kinds of situations?
Right. So the exercise we teach to help people motivate themselves with compassion to make a change or to, you know, reach their full potential. And perfection is not going to be possible, right? That's just accepting that. Mm-hmm. But the first thing is really seeing what is the self-critic trying to do, because usually the self-critic is trying to point out a problem, like you might get fired from your job or you won't get a boyfriend and you'll be rejected. So recognizing how the self-critic is trying to keep you safe by trying to help you make a change. But then getting in touch with the inner compassionate voice, the essence of which is, you know, I love you and I don't want you to suffer, right? Really getting in touch with that part of yourself that cares so deeply and does not want you to suffer. And that, that feeling, the desire to alleviate suffering, from that place will spring forward potential actions. You know, suffering will still be there, right? That's mm-hmm. Buddha's first noble truth. Life isn't perfect. There is suffering. Mm-hmm. But if you really care deeply about your own happiness and are committed to not causing yourself suffering, you will explore ways, well, how can I start being more successful at work in a way that is authentic to me? How can I maybe... maybe I can exercise more, start taking yoga to make me feel better about myself and my body, or start finding men that are more interested in who I am on the inside rather than who I am on the outside. There will always be pathways that are available to maximize your well-being and minimize your suffering. You just have to get in touch with that deep inner desire to minimize your suffering, and the rest, I think, will follow.
Right. I'm often struck by how self-compassion overlaps being a good ally to oneself.
Yes.
It's really about being a good friend to yourself. I mean, one part of being a friend is to really be sympathetic and commiserate in a very healthy way. Compassion, as you know, compatio, to suffer with, to feel with. So that's really one part. But very close to that is the ally who says, well, first of all, there's a lot more to being happy in life than having these results. And you can still be happy even if you don't have those results. And actually, to some reasonable extent, is there any way you could have a little more of those results? Of course, without falling into the trap of chasing after them forever. So that overlapping of self-compassion and self-encouragement, I see a lot in people.
Yeah, and in our program, actually, we teach both, you might say, loving kindness for oneself as well as compassion. So compassion is really only relevant in the midst of suffering by definition, but there's a whole other aspect of being a good, positive resource, good friend to yourself, encouraging yourself, appreciating yourself, appreciating your good qualities. That's also an important part of being a friend to yourself.
Yeah.
Which is part of the equation, yeah.
Yeah, if I'm going to be a friend of myself and sort of say something for general purposes, and it applies really throughout this entire series, every so often, for example, when you, Kristen, were presenting the research on gender differences and self-compassion, or mm-hmm. when I'm also talking, or as I did last interview with Kelly McGonigal, Dr. McGonigal from Stanford, you know, when you bring up any kind of group, it's always a very tricky business because, of course, most research is about the average of the group, and then unfortunately the language forces us to reify the group and generalize from the group to every member in the group, mm-hmm. when in fact often the difference between, let's use gender here, the average male and the average female in terms of self-compassion is fairly small compared
it
to
is.
The differences among all males or among all females with regard to that, you know, variable, let's say self-compassion. In other words, as you know, you know, within group diversity is much greater than between group diversity, and yet the language forces us to generalize to all the members of the class. So I want to apologize in advance for any fuzziness about that, and also point out that oftentimes people feel pathologized or mistreated around their membership in a class that's historically been stereotyped or mistreated. So I think, you know, it's important to be careful about the language, especially the way it can impact people. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to try to be clear about this bit here. Well, we're moving toward the end, although we still have some remaining great minutes, so I want to use them as best I can and ask you about self-compassion for caregivers, particularly caregivers dealing with difficult situations in which often it's not uncommon they'll blame themselves for the difficulty. A child with special needs, perhaps, could be an aging parent, could be any kind of a difficult situation, could be a matter of social justice. These are all in environments where people are trying to help something get better. How can they have compassion for themselves in those situations?
Yeah, I think self-compassion is absolutely crucial in caregiving situations. And more than just, I mean, often the advice for caregivers is self-care. You should take care of yourself, have a glass of wine, see friends, exercise. Well, that's great. I mean, absolutely, you should do that. But it doesn't help you in the heat of the moment. So as you mentioned before, my son's autistic, and thank God I had a very well-established self-compassion practice, first when he got diagnosed, so that I actually gave myself permission to grieve. I think a lot of parents feel guilty grieving for the child that they love, but I knew that I had to give myself permission to feel that, to get through that, so then it no longer blocked me, that I, you know, could actually open to him more by giving myself the compassion I needed for my own grief. But even more, in the heat of the moment, one of the difficulties with autism is the tantruming. And when he was younger, he used to have terrible tantrums. And of course, autistic kids don't look any different than other kids. So you have a four-year-old throwing a tantrum that you would normally see in an 18-month-old, and the whole entire world thinks that you're just being a bad mother. So when Rowan would really lose it and be very struggling, I would focus my energy primarily on myself. So here's an example. Imagine being on a plane. My husband's British, actually, so this happened when he was four, flying to England, transatlantic flight. Rowan, I don't know what happened, some sensory issue, but he just throws an all-out tantrum, you know, flailing, screaming tantrum on the plane. Every single passenger in the plane looking at us like they wish we were dead. I mean, in a way, you can't blame them. It's really, really difficult, but you feel all these dagger eyes on you. Mm. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? I don't know, maybe I'll take him to the bathroom, and if he screams in there, maybe it'll muffle the cries. Take him to the bathroom, occupied, of course it's occupied. So imagine being in that little space outside the bathroom on the airplane with your son absolutely screaming, flailing, hitting the floor. What option did I have at that point? The only option I had was self-compassion. So while he was having his meltdown, I was touching myself, hugging myself, trying not to be too obvious, but I was actually focused on myself. This is so hard. This is so hard. This is so hard. I'm so sorry. This is happening, Kristen. I'm here for you. I'm here for you. I was just trying to shower myself with compassion for how difficult it was, validating the fact that I wanted to jump out of the airplane, but really trying to be kind and supportive, just as if I had, you know, a whole group of friends hugging me and supporting me through that moment. And I can tell you, it got me through. It got me through. It was still really difficult, but the fact that I was able to so intentionally focus on how hard it was for me, when actually he was the one really suffering and losing it at that moment, is what kept me able to keep my heart open. Keep my heart open to myself, and therefore keep my heart open to him, and therefore you know, to keep myself from melting down or burning out. And over again, I found that when I was actually with him in his worst moments, the more I could put my attention on soothing and comforting myself, the more not only could I sustain it, but what I found would be that if I could soothe and comfort myself with compassion, and I would start to calm down, then he would start to calm down. He would start picking up on my soothed and calmed and comforted mindset, so that often that would actually help change the tenor of the interaction. So I think, whether it's your mother with Alzheimer's or your spouse with an alcohol problem or whatever it is, giving yourself full permission to be kind and compassionate for the empathetic pain, the pain you have from being a caregiver, will allow you to keep your heart open to yourself, keep your heart open to the person you're caring for, and ultimately keep you from burning out so that you can, again, have that oxygen mask on for yourself so you can help others. Mm. So I can't recommend self-compassion for caregivers strongly enough, because it saved my ass. Saved my ass, and it got me through.
And well, now, Kristen, there's nothing like speaking from direct experience to really give a lot of authority to what a person is saying. As you were speaking there, I was reminded by a quote from the Buddha. You have spoken about your own background in that tradition. And it is, if one going down into a river, swollen and swiftly flowing, is carried away by the current, how can one help others across? And to me, so clearly when you talk about self-compassion in that sense, I mean, you're really speaking about using it in that way. Well, we're nearing the end of our time here. And so, unfortunately, with regret, I'm going to have to move toward our last question, if I could. It's a question I routinely ask. I've asked every other guest on the series. It is, if you could offer one encouragement to people watching this series, what would it be?
It really would be to honor that little, I would say, guardian angel that's on your shoulder, or that tool of being a friend to yourself that is available precisely when you need it most. Self-compassion is amazing exactly when you're at your worst, when you feel the most horrible about yourself or your life. If you can just open your heart to that suffering and treat yourself like a good friend, you can be there for yourself at all moments. And you know how to do it. You just have to give yourself permission to be that good friend to yourself. So just remembering to use the skill that you actually already have. It's easier than you think.
Perfect way to end. Thank you very much, Kristen. And I really encourage, my encouragement is that people check out your book, Self-Compassion, as well as the self-compassion training that you're doing, as well as even your first book, Horse Boy, about your work with your son and the movie related to that. So I'm going to turn it over to Randy momentarily. I'll say bye for now. I'll see you all next week as we meet with Jean Houston, and may the efforts of people like you, Kristen, really help this world become a better place. So thank you again.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's been just an absolute pleasure.
Great.
And as Rick said, it's a good place to end, but I'm going to close out tonight with just a little bit of information for people that are either taking the course or would like to refer people that they know that are interested in this program to how to or sign up and register. So this is the sixth of seven of these live interviews with Rick Hansen of Buddha's Brain, with seven different experts in various fields of the compassionate brain. And once this course is actually over, the seven-week session is over, they'll be archived on our website, and you'll be able to go back and either re-listen or catch ones that you've missed. Also, if you know anyone that's interested in this kind of material, we're not making any money on this. It's costing ourselves money to bring this out into the world, so we believe in it very strongly. And one thing that we've included is that we've found a company that's giving continuing education units, seven for this seven-week session. So if you know someone, as Kristen talks about, the importance of self-compassion for people that are caregivers, there's a lot of caregivers out there in the world who need continuing education units. So if you know anyone, this is a way of getting this information to people and also making it useful for their accumulation of continuing education units for each year. But this is the end of the sixth session. Next week, on Monday, November 19th, we'll be back at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you'd like to listen to this session again, you'll have to wait until Wednesday at 7 p.m. That's how long it takes us to get it up into the archive. But all the previous sessions, all five, are already there. You can go back and listen to them anytime. And now for Sounds True, this is Randy Rourke. Thanks for being with us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.